Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, it's kind of cool to be alive when they discover new things they never knew about the soil and earthworms and weeds.
We've got the Columbus of earthworms here.
We do. It's sort of
neat. That's kind of funny.
But we're going to talk today with Dr. Emmy Renier. She's a soil or weed scientist, rather, at Ohio State University, and she's researching the apparent relationship between giant ragweed and earthworms.
It's amazing. You slap yourself in the forehead and say, wait a minute, yeah. Earthworms, ragweed?
Yeah.
Who'd have thought?
And, you know, once I started reading the material, it sort of made sense, really,
yeah.
that they would mess with seeds on the soil surface,
yeah,
right?
When I first heard this, I thought, wait a minute, this is something like for Geraldo, but actually the more you get into it,
yeah.
there's a real serious study going on.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. So we're going to find out what that serious study is coming up today on Homegrown. We're also delighted to talk to John Elsley, one of those great characters in gardening in the United States and in England, of course. But Bob, I know you know John pretty well.
Yeah, I've known John a long time, and he's got that British accent. That alone makes him worth having on the show, I think. I'm such a sucker for that kind of thing. But he really has rubbed elbows and shovels with some of the great plant people in England and the United States.
And he's considered, I mean, honestly, he's considered one of those great plants people as well. So
he'll downplay that.
Forget. Yeah.
No. So it'll be fun to talk to John and listen to what he's got to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll run off madly in all directions as usual, I'm
sure.
That's
right. And he works with another one of your favorite guys, Roy Klim.
Roy Klim,
and his Songbird, or Song Sparrow.
Yeah, Song Sparrow Nurseries in Wisconsin. So any credibility is going out the window this week.
Yeah,
I got two friends on the show.
On your end.
And I don't care.
So yes, that's coming up on Homegrown. I hope that you'll stick with us. What's going on in your garden?
Actually, not enough rain.
Uh-huh.
I'm dealing with that. But I'm just back to turning on the hoses and doing what I can to keep things going. That windstorm a couple weeks ago, just not only did it blow leaves off and trees down, it scorched the leaves. I've never seen leaves browned from wind before.
Yeah, it's just sort of depressing. It's like it just... like mulch blew away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it looks like because flame burned up shrubs and just the desiccation, you know? So it's like I'm kind of hoping that fall, as much as I hate it, that fall happens quickly because it'll allow the trees to be less stressed, allow stuff to be less stressed if they go ahead and get rid of their leaves.
Yeah, I totally refuse to give up and I'm going to water till the cows come home, but... but I did, somebody asked me the other day if they thought the scorched leaves would mean a less bright fall. I think it might.
And absolutely, because those leaves won't, I mean, the tissue is dead now where they're all brown and scorched.
Right.
So, I mean, if there's a tree that's not scorched, you'll still have your senescence and that draining of the color. But because actually, if I recall... a lot of what allows us to have brighter color has to do with like warm days and cool nights, doesn't
it? Exactly.
So if we, you know, have that sort of trend, we shouldn't have too bad of a fall. But if it's all burned up, then there's not going to be any color draining from those foliage.
Well, I got the big picture in mind. We had a great spring, a great early summer, a great late summer, and I'm going to deal with this. And next spring's coming.
Yeah, it always does.
That's how I look at things.
Yeah. Calendar. What else is going on?
Yeah, John Elsley previously mentioned John's going to be here on Thursday, October 9th to speak at the Midwest Peony Society at 6 p.m. at Linden City Hall.
Mm-hmm.
No charge, but you have to bring a potluck meal, which may mean I got to stay home.
Yeah, or bring your wife.
I don't know. I may have to go buy a Hershey bar.
So we'll be hearing from, we'll get a little preview of that coming up in the second part of the show. But in the meantime, Bob, are you ready to learn about the symbiotic relationship between giant ragweed and earthworms?
I waited my whole life for this moment.
All right. Well, here it is. Dr. Emmy Renier is joining us. She's a weed scientist in the Department of Horticulture and Crop Science at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. Her research team has uncovered a significant relationship between earthworms and the spread of giant ragweed. Dr. Renier, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for contacting me.
Sure. Ragweed's on a lot of people's minds right now, I think, because of allergy season. And in the Ohio Valley, we have it really bad.
Mm-hmm.
But you have been researching with some other folks the relationship between ragweed, giant ragweed to be specific, and earthworms. Can you tell us, I mean, how you guys first discovered that there was any link at all between the two?
Well, it was really sheer chance.
Uh-huh.
That we discovered this link because I work quite a bit with my husband, Kent Harrison. He's my primary collaborator.
Uh-huh.
And we had been doing research for a couple of years on giant ragweed to try to better understand why it's such a successful weedy species.
Mm-hmm.
because it's got a number of characteristics that really kind of go against the sort of profile of a normal weed. And one of those things is that it's a native plant, so it has a bunch of natural enemies, especially organisms that eat the seeds.
Okay.
And a lot of the seeds disappear from the soil surface. So we were scratching our heads wondering, how is this weed so successful? It's usually listed as one of the top 10 weeds in crop fields, and it occurs in a bunch of other environments as well. And we thought maybe one thing we noticed about the weed that's quite unique is that it has seeds that differ from plant to plant in size and in shape. And it's really kind of astonishing. If you collect the seeds from one plant and look at them, put them in a pile, collect the seeds from a different plant, maybe right next to it, put them in a pile and look at them, they'll be different. And the size range is quite considerable. And we thought, well, maybe this variety in seed shape and size is important, and maybe it affects how quickly the seeds get buried in the soil, because we knew that if they stay on the surface, mice especially, and even birds and beetles will eat the seeds. So we were doing just a simple experiment of laying seeds out on the soil surface of different shapes and sizes and going back every day and recording how many were still on the surface. And as rain fell, you know, some would get buried more quickly and so on. And that's when we started to see that these seeds were kind of moving around oddly.
That's funny.
And they were turning up in these little mounds of dirt. And at the time, we didn't know anything about earthworms. So, but I had learned a little bit about, I had seen these sort of so-called middens that this particular species creates on the soil surface. And I thought, well, those seeds are being, you know, they're flowing with rainwater over the surface, or the wind is pushing them, and they're just kind of getting lodged in these mounds. And then we started to take apart the mounds, and we found the seeds inside them, and it just became more and more strange.
Because you're just a weed scientist, so like your perspective at this point really is just coming from your knowledge as a weed scientist, or a soil scientist, excuse me, not like an earthworm expert.
Well, you see, I'm a weed scientist.
Okay, a weed scientist.
By training.
Okay.
Yes. So this whole area of earthworms was completely new, and I think I'm not a soil scientist, so
So your
soil, it's that whole area was new to me.
Okay,
yeah, Doctor, I'm not sure I know the answer to this, but how many seeds will the average ragweed plant produce in a year?
It will produce usually somewhere between 1,000 and 5,000 seeds per plant, and that seems like a lot, but compared to other weedy species, that's very small.
Okay,
it is, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so you discovered this relationship by accident. So where do you go from there?
Well, from there we were just so shocked that it became a matter of documenting this and determining whether this behavior was deliberate, and just, you know, how many seeds did the earthworm bury, and setting up a whole series of experiments to look at it more closely and to confirm those initial observations.
Mm-hmm. Well, give me a sense of how big an area were you documenting. Did you tape off some 10 square feet of ragweed and count the worms or what?
Well, gosh, we've done so many different experiments. Yeah. But initially we just started off in, we were just looking, you know, at an area maybe 5 feet by 5 feet square, something like that, for these little studies. And then we expanded to a larger study where each plot was small, but the whole area was, I don't know, a quarter of an acre maybe.
Well, did your brethren think you were nuts?
Well, yeah, my fellow colleagues really did not believe me.
Right.
And we went outside to, in fact, my husband didn't believe me.
That's not unusual, though, in some cases, right?
That's right. One evening I came home and I said, you've got to see this, because I had gone out at night. That's when earthworms are active. And to convince myself, I had gone out at night and actually seen them grab these seeds.
So you caught them in action.
And bury them, yeah. Uh-huh. But I had taken a camera with me, but I was just too numb with disbelief. I was afraid to take any pictures. So I went home and told my husband he had to go take a look, and he took some pictures. And even then, our colleagues, after looking at the pictures, claimed that we were gluing the seeds to the earthworms.
So you could literally see them picking up the seeds and taking them back down.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right, and it was very strange because they have a, you know, I never really thought about earthworms having a mouth, for example. Of course they do, but their mouth can kind of open and, you know, take different...
Shapes.
Yeah, so they come out and they can grasp objects fairly tightly, where they kind of seem to try a couple holds, and then when they get a tight hold, they seem to sense that. And when they do, when they have that hold, then they kind of chirp back into the burrow really quickly.
Huh. Okay, from that point, like, is it speculation? Can you tell what they're actually doing with the seeds? Are they eating the seeds? Are they using them in some sort of way? I mean, like, what's the purpose?
Well, that is the really unanswered question at this point. It really is. And it's well known that they collect organic debris from the soil surface, more often leaves, that they take into their burrows. And in that burrow environment, which is very moist, has lots of microorganisms, is rich in nitrogen and phosphorus and organic matter, that material can decompose relatively quickly. And then the earthworms feed on either the fungi or other microorganisms that colonize that organic material, or they can take off little bits since the leaves would soften and ingest them directly. But with these seeds, they're far too big for the earthworms to swallow because they're limited to particles of about the size of 2 millimeters.
Mm-hmm.
So how large, if you can characterize, how large is a ragweed seed?
Ragweed seeds, but the smallest one is about 4 millimeters in length that we found, and they can get up to about a centimeter half.
Which is what, compared to inches?
That's about half an inch at the most.
Wow.
That's probably the it is a very large seed compared to most weed seeds. Yeah. So anywhere from, I guess, about a quarter to a half an inch.
So any speculation as to how, if we don't think that they're eating them, any speculation as to why otherwise they may grab these large seeds?
Yes, they may. It would be speculation, but they line their burrows with them. Before we let go of the idea of them eating the seeds, the seeds have an outer hull that decomposes relatively quickly. And so it's possible that they could feed on that outer hull.
Okay.
So that would be kind of like grazing on the surface of the seed. They might be using it to strengthen the walls of the burrow. There, some researchers that have looked at this include even Charles Darwin, who did a long studied earthworms for a long period of time. And he speculated that they line their burrows with inert materials such as bits of tile and beads as insulation against the cold. But nobody has really looked at this.
Can't really ask them, huh?
I don't know much about worm reproduction, but do the babies feed on these things too, or just the adults?
Well, the babies of earthworms, that's a good question. They seem to, of this species, they seem to live in the area around the parent burrow. And it's speculated that they kind of, they behave more as a different class of earthworms that lives entirely in the soil and feeds on directly on soil and any organic matter that's mixed in with the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably wouldn't be feeding directly on these seeds, but they might be feeding on sort of that rich organic material right around the burrow.
Is it just ragweed or other seeds are hauling down there too?
They will haul down a number of other seed species. We did a test with, 10 or 11 different seeds of crop plants and also other weeds. And they took every one of them down.
Wow.
But they showed preferences among them.
That's interesting.
Giant ragweed and sunflower seeds were among the seeds that they liked the best.
Well, they're ambitious.
No kidding. They are going for the really big ones,
wow.
huh?
Yeah.
That's interesting. Emmy, in terms of why this is important or why this sort of is, you know, making the news for farmers and crop management, that type of thing, because as you had said before, it was confusing as to why ragweed was so good at perpetuating its species, right?
Right, right.
So what does this mean in terms of weed management in crop fields?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer because What it does primarily is it contributes to our understanding of why weeds thrive in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
And typically in crop production, when fields are put under no tillage,
mm-hmm.
the large seeded weeds disappear because they are not buried in the soil and they're not protected, and the small seeded weeds tend to increase.
Mm-hmm.
And so under no tillage conditions, however, this favors this earthworm species because mm-hmm. it lives in these permanent burrows and it's got plenty of litter to feed on. So this relationship that we've found may help explain why ragweed is able to persist in areas that where tillage is sufficiently infrequent so as to support these earthworms.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of contributes to our understanding of the factors that contribute to the success of this particular weedy species.
Mm-hmm.
And an area of sort of emerging interest to among weed scientists and crop producers, especially for organic crop production, is to try to exploit ecological processes, you know, in the mm-hmm. agricultural ecosystem to reduce weeds. And one of those things is seed predation. So there's research underway to test the idea of having little refugia that would encourage mice populations and insect populations that feed on weed seeds,
mm-hmm.
Because they really remove and destroy a number of seeds. But in areas where the earthworm is present, such ideas might not be as effective.
Right.
So it's kind of
kind of bad news, really, because you want earthworms for soil health.
That's right.
But
that's,
now it seems like they can be blamed for helping ragweed persist.
That's right.
Shoot.
Yeah. I mean, you certainly wouldn't advocate controlling your earthworms because they're doing a tremendous amount of good in the field. So it's more like be aware that if you have earthworms, be aware that
you may have bad ragweed problems.
That's right, and take extra precautions. Make sure they don't reproduce because the earthworms will help those seeds, you know, get into the soil.
I've always, when people complain that they have really bad mole problems, I've always said, well, at least it's likely that you have really good soil because they love earthworms. So I guess, you know, if you've got a lot of ragweed, you've got really good soil as well.
Yeah.
Doctor, I'm curious now, how far widespread has your research gone? Are other states and other agriculture agents digging into this, so to speak?
Yes, we have a collaboration with the with Adam Davis at the University of Illinois, and with weed scientists in Indiana as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we're hopeful that we'll be able to collaborate with some weed scientists in Wisconsin. So we've done a survey of those three states, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, to see if the earthworms are present across that geographic area and if ragweed seems to be associated with their burrows.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been quite interesting to observe.
Are any allergy associations interested in your research?
No, I haven't been contacted by any allergy associations. I haven't attempted to contact them, but...
They would be interested, I think. They should be interested, at least, right?
Have the other states found the same results you have? There's a link between the earthworms and ragweed?
Well, they do find a link between earthworms and ragweed. And my husband and I went on a trip across the three states to be able to kind of see this ourselves. But you do see differences. In Illinois, that link does not seem to be as strong. In Ohio and in Indiana... when you're in a field where both the earthworms and ragweed are present, you just see the ragweed seedlings really clumped in the earthworm burrows.
Mm. Huh.
And in Illinois, that association seems to be a little weaker.
Any suggestions as to why?
We think it might be because in Illinois there's a generally more tillage practiced than in Ohio, so the earthworm populations seem to be lower.
Mm-hmm.
And so being more sparsely distributed... you just don't see that tight of an association.
Hmm.
Well, how do you feel as an earthworm ragweed pioneer? You really plowed some new ground here.
It's very, very interesting. It's really a lot of fun to having studied primarily weeds, you know, and their growth patterns and competition and so on. It's been really fun to look at their interactions with other organisms,
mm-hmm.
and especially earthworms, because that's just such an odd kind of a relationship, and there's so many unknowns and mysteries yet to unravel.
Hmm. Well, we'll be We'll be checking in with you then to see what else you find out.
As will 5 million fishermen, I think.
Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Sure, you're welcome.
Very interesting. Dr. Emmy Renier is a weed scientist in the Department of Horticulture and Crop Science at Ohio State University in Columbus. Her research has uncovered a significant relationship between earthworms and the spread of ragweed. And of course, for more information on giant ragweed, earthworms, and Dr. Renier's work, please go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, plant expert John Elsley talks about great gardens and great gardeners. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Moving right along to the almost the other side of the ocean, but
almost.
Not quite.
Not quite.
Yeah, our guest is going to be John Elsley. He's an old friend, an old plantsman, and knows more than, he's forgotten more than I know about plants, actually. John Elsley is a plant impresario, if not raconteur. He's got broad gardening experience on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean. He's been an advisor to many great nurserymen and nurseries. He's with us today to give a sneak preview of his upcoming talk in Louisville and to talk about some great gardeners he's met on both sides of the pond. John, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, pleasure to be with you, Bob.
Let's catch our listeners up on a little bit of your history. I know you started off in the wrong side of the Atlantic, but you got over here 20 years or so ago. Give us some background on you, please.
Well, actually, I've been over here 38 years now.
Ah, okay.
Wow.
So, yeah, I was born in England and raised in England and educated in England. I went to university in Leicester in the centre of England, did botany, but also had a training at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew in horticulture.
Mm-hmm.
And then worked for the Royal Horticultural Society at their gardens at Wisley for about 8 years, and then came over to this side of the Atlantic in the very early 1970s to take a position at the Missouri Botanical Garden.
Hmm. That's right, yeah.
You've been at some of the great institutions in both countries then, huh?
Well, yes, you could say so, but yeah. As you say, I would agree with you, but I might be a little biased. But, yeah, they certainly are. I've been very, very fortunate indeed. And then after I was at nearly 10 years at Missouri, I kind of jumped the bridge into the commercial world and worked for Park Seed and Wayside Gardens for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Down here in South Carolina before joining my friend Roy Clem nearly 9 years ago now and helping him with his development of new plants and particularly our little mail order catalog.
So, John, has that always kind of been your, I guess, your passion?
Yes,
is developing new plants?
Well, I mean, I'm as interested in old established plants as new ones. But of course, this day and age and in the commercial world, everybody seems to kind of think newer is better and all that kind of syndrome.
Yeah.
John, we tend to think England has a 400-year head start on us in gardening, and I think it does, but kind of fill us in on your almost 40 years in the States. What have you seen in terms of progression in gardens here in this country?
Well, you really can't compare the two because, as you say, in Britain, you have a very, very long and distinguished history, which does go back about 400 years, doesn't it, actually?
Right.
But one has to remember that in Britain, you're basically dealing with one climate. Now, the British would disagree with that, but they're basically a Zone 7, and there are parts of the country a little bit milder, and other parts are not quite as mild. But the big thing here is the huge difference in climates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and the huge, well, the first of all, the physical size of the country, it still staggers to, it still amazes me. And then you get a huge range of climates, so you have to look at gardening in this country on a regional basis, depending on how you define a region. It can be very small, it can be larger, of course. But really, there's not a lot in common when you look at certainly the extremes of these various regions. So therefore, you have to be aware of the conditions and be very much aware about the limitation of plants. You know, it's very dangerous, and I'm as guilty as this, making this mistake as many others, when you start promoting plants in catalogs and writing about them. You know, you automatically kind of imply that they can grow all over the country, you know, from, say, Zone 3 to Zone 8. Well, that's basically, in many cases, not true, because Zone 7 on the West Coast, for example, is totally different to Zone 7 on the East Coast.
That's a good point.
So that's really the big difference. I mean, there's a whole range of different climates, and then you've got a whole range of plants that adapt to these various climates to a, you know, greater or lesser degree.
Well, do you find Americans are more sophisticated, interested in a more variety of plants than they were, say, 40 years ago?
Oh, there's no question about that. Absolutely no question that they are. I mean, I think they're much more sophisticated than they were 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why is that?
Well, I think generally they've become more, you know, gardening has become more popular, but both at a home level and also at what I call like a commercial landscape level. Mm-hmm. You know, cities are becoming, if you go to Europe, particularly in Britain, you know, I mean, the local parks departments, they do a great job, particularly in the coastal towns, and you know, walk around London, you see all the parks and that sort of thing. It's just a way of life. But I think that's becoming more important in this country now.
Mm-hmm.
You've got
more
places
accessible.
Like Chicago, you know, right. And they've made a big effort the last 10 years with their public gardens.
You know, gardening's more accessible. You know, people are more interested in, you know, just beautifying things, whether it's their own backyard or whether it's like civic places or public places. But what about like the characters behind the whole scene? Do you know what I mean? It's like, people sometimes fuel initially the excitement over things that become popular. So who do you see in the U.S. as being some of those people that in the last 20 years or 30 years have actually, you know, fueled the interest?
You mean the individuals themselves?
Yeah.
Oh, there's an awful lot of them.
So who are some of the most interesting
ones?
There's been
some very, very important nurserymen of, you know, develop groups of plants over the years. People like Bill Flemmer at Princeton Nurseries with his, some of his crab apples and introductions of other plants and some native plants. I think in his case, a plant like hydrangea quercifolia, you know, the native oak-leafed hydrangea.
Yeah.
You've got Bruce Briggs on the West Coast who developed a lot with rhododendrons. And, I mean, there's an awful lot of people. Mm-hmm. And then you think of people like Roy Clem and his family that have developed peonies over four generations mm-hmm. now.
So, John, do you think it kind of goes back to what you said initially about it, almost a buyer beware to a certain degree because the U.S. is so large and the zones are so diverse?
Well, certainly buyer beware. But
so people like these folks that are developing and working on certain types of plants, certain species of plants, they're making it easier for us, do you
think?
Oh,
yeah, they're making it easier because, I mean, there's no other country in the world, in my opinion, that's introduced more new good plants for the United States over the last 20 years, 20, 25 years, than the United States itself.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of breeding and selecting of like groups like magnolias, for example. All the major work in more recent years has been done in the United States. And these are people that are breeding plants and looking at plants for use in this country. I mean, I think of a person like Father Fiella, who
right.
developed a whole new range of lilacs. Exactly. But they were lilacs bred for American conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Much shorter in stature, bloomed at a much earlier age, very, very pest and disease resistant, particularly mm-hmm. for American conditions, as opposed to the old European hybrids, for
right.
example, which will grow 25, 30 feet high and have flowers at the end of branches. His were grown to succeed in Midwestern conditions in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And people like David Leach, who are breeding rhododendrons for the Midwest. So these are American breeders breeding plants for American conditions.
You mentioned, I was talking to you earlier about Bruce Briggs and tissue culture. Talk some about that.
Yeah, well, he's passed away now, so
yeah.
Many of these people, I was very fortunate to know them. It's one of the things I'm going to kind of talk a little bit about when I come to Louisville. Well, he was the first to make a commitment to really do a tissue culture lab, and today it's still going, that same lab. It's greatly expanded, but it's one of the most successful commercial labs in the world.
Now, where's he located? Where was he located?
In Olympia, Washington.
Okay, and explain tissue culture a little bit. The people don't understand that.
Well, it's basically a somewhat relatively inexpensive way of producing a large number of plants quickly. You'll take a very small, either one down to even one cell of a part of a plant, and then you can multiply that up so a new plant can be quickly produced in large numbers.
Wow.
This is in theory. I mean, but there are a lot of problems with it, but that has been successful with many groups of plants and with many plants. It's a very important method of increasing numbers of plants quickly.
How about David Austin and his roses?
Well, David Austin was an interesting rose. Well, he still is. He's still alive in England, producing a whole group of roses called the English roses, which were introduced in the early 1980s. I think 1982 were the first two of his series to come out at the Chelsea Flower Show.
I thought it was older than that.
And, well, he'd been breeding roses before that.
Okay.
In fact, his probably most famous introduction, which was probably 20 years earlier, is one called Constant Spry. It's a climbing rose, but it only bloomed once. So his English roses, basically, were a completely... They're the first major group of new roses for over 100 years, I think, actually. They resemble the old roses in their form and their fragrance, but they use some of the modern roses to bring a wider range of flower colors into them, and also repeat blooming, which is the important thing. Now, again, unfortunately, he's introduced, as with most breeders, way too many roses, actually. But, I mean, it's the same with daylilies, hostas, and everything else. There's way too many. You know, heuchera is another example. You can't sort them all out. At least I can't, anyhow. But the problem is with David's roses, many of them, well, they're all bred in Britain. And when they come across here into our varying climates, they act very differently. Still, I still feel that some of his early introductions are his best. Graham Stewart Thomas, for example, is a wonderful rose with a totally unique color. It was a large shrub rose in Britain, but here it's a climber in many of our climates. And there's a question of disease resistance with a number of them. They do better in some parts of this country than others, but again, you know, very romantic group of roses with a tremendous fragrance, many of them.
Then there was a woman working on hellebores. Helen
Ballard, yeah. She was really the first person in Britain to seriously develop a strain of hellebores, actually. She was followed by a number of others, although many of the modern ones that we see actually have their origins a couple of generations or three or four generations and selectors back with Helen Ballard's one, the pure colors. And she went back to many of the species and started crossing the individual species to get, like, into the Lenten roses. She was able to get a lot of different colors, like blacks and all this sort of thing.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like we can look to these examples, and now hellebores are so much more popular and so much more accessible and available than they were just 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
And probably because of her.
And that's why I started doing, in fact, it was Graham Thomas in England suggested that I start looking at introducing some of them and growing them from seed, because really they were unknown.
Yeah.
I won't say, well, 15, 20 years ago, let's say that. They weren't. You know, now, I mean, they're justifiably very popular.
Yeah.
You know, in America, the history is somewhat short with many of these things.
Right. Now, you've known many of these people personally.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate, you know, to have known many of these people. I was fortunate to be probably at the end of an era, really. A lot of these people kind of passed away, like Alan Bloom with his perennials.
Right.
Around the turn of the century, around the year 2000. So I started my first job was in the mid-60s, I suppose, when I first went to work for the RHS, like 1968, actually, I think it was. So I was still able to, you know, get to know these people and, you know, travel around the country. And then when I came to this country, you know, with my work particularly at, well, St. Louis to a degree, but even more so when I joined Park and Wayside, I was able to get around to all the major nurseries in this country and, you know, meet, you know, the Bill Flemmers and Father Fiella. It was really through Roy Clem's encouragement and Bruce Briggs and some of the Magnolia breeders. You know, I mean, a lot of these people.
Well, let's talk about, because you're going to speak to the Midwest Peony Society, let's talk about Roy Clem and peonies a little bit and what what that's all about.
Yeah, well, he, of course, is what? Does he represent, Bob, I think, the fourth generation of that family?
Right.
To breed herbaceous peonies, initially. And his father and grandfather, you know, started growing these in the Midwest, and there were a lot of peony, a number of peony breeders at that, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And Roy, as a young person, was able to get to know these people and get a number of their plants and incorporate them into his own lines of peonies. And I think one can say without any question that they're the finest introductions anywhere in the world today. I don't know of anywhere else where they're seriously actually breeding herbaceous peonies but the United States. I don't think there's anything in Britain now, and there may be a little bit in New Zealand and these kind of countries, but nothing like we have here at all.
Is there a kind of a universal personality thread between all these great plant people?
Well, they're all eccentric, like you, me. I mean, you know, the gardeners tend to be, and horticulturists, you know, usually very, you know, very interesting. If they're interested in plants, you know, money is not the dominant thing usually. And they're really interested in what they do, and kind of somewhat eccentric, I guess. There aren't many bad apples in the barrel, are there?
No, sir, no.
There are a few, but everybody knows them, you know, so
Bob
everybody avoids them.
John, Bob asking you that question is probably one of the best examples of hello pot, this is kettle, I've ever heard.
Yeah.
I never thought of it that way.
You know, it's kind of it's almost a Freemasonry, really, in the gardening world.
Indeed.
So, I mean, I think we're very fortunate here because I think really where new plants and that are concerned, we're in the center of it in this country and have been for a number of years.
That's good to think that.
Yeah, I mean, there are some exceptions. You'd mentioned like David Austin's roses, and we get a few things out of Germany and these countries, you know, in perennial lines, but heavens above, you think of our daylilies, our hostas, and our peonies, and all that sort of stuff.
Well, John, great to talk to you as always, and my lawyer will be in touch, but looking forward to having you come to Louisville.
Yes, and I'll talk a lot about these kind of people and basically my kind of history and hopefully make it a fairly light, entertaining evening.
Sounds good. Thank you, John.
Yes, thanks both of you.
Plant expert John Elsley will speak at the Midwest Peony Society's meeting Thursday, October 9th at 6 p.m. at Linden City Hall. For more information on the talk or John, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got a Bob quiz and a plant story. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown.
Bob Hill and Janine Wishy.
I was hoping you'd fill in us.
I know.
I just
all of a sudden he forgot who he was.
How long would this pregnant pause last?
Yeah.
It was just last week, Miss Wishy, you were talking about a groundhog.
My barn hog.
At your place.
Uh-huh.
And
lives
you were wondering what a good name might be for it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you some good names after we give you a groundhog quiz.
And you were supposed to do research on what kind of behavior and stuff I was to expect from my barn hog.
Heavily researched.
Okay.
Heavily researched.
All right, we shall see.
Are you ready?
Okay.
First,
the quiz.
Right up your alley,
a famous
Carol.
Bob quiz.
The Latin name for the groundhog is,
oh, Lord.
1, Poxitani phyllis, 2, Digger odellus, 3, Marmota dakota, 4, Marmota monax, or 5, Congressmana Americana.
What was that last one?
Congressmana Americana.
Oh, what was...
This is politics, kid.
I'm thinking Marmota, the Marmota one.
Marmota Dakota or Marmota Monax?
Monax.
You got it.
Because, you know, marmots.
Yep.
That's exactly. Kind of like a little creature like
it's
that.
It's in the marmot family.
Okay.
There are alternate names for the groundhog besides groundhog. I'll give you five opportunities. You pick the three most common.
Okay.
Ready? Write them down, kid.
Okay, I'm ready.
First one's Chuck E. Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
The Land Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
The Whistle Pig. The Woodchuck. And the Scurry Hog.
Scurry Hog, Whistle Pig, and Land beaver.
How could you leave out woodchuck?
Because that's a beaver.
It's a groundhog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Which one was wrong? Whistlepig?
Scurry hog.
Oh.
So it's actually land beaver, whistlepig and woodchuck. But I'm glad I'm glad you picked scurry hog because I was proud of that.
Do groundhogs chew on wood like a woodchuck?
Question three.
Okay.
How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
So does that
mean
they don't?
Question three. How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood? 1 acre? 5 acres? 1 rick? 1 rick in a rack? 1 rickety rack?
1 rick.
I have no idea.
Did I understand that differently all of a sudden after all these years that woodchucks can't really chuck wood because it just said if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Apparently. I'm just giving a quiz, kid.
I'm even more confused now, Bob.
The name woodchuck actually came from King Charles III, who had a thing for groundhogs, a nickname given King Charles III by his enemies, an Algonquin or Narragansett Indian word that sounded like woodchuck, the name for an American pioneer named Charles who could chuck 10 rickety racks an hour.
It has to be the Narragansett word.
You got it.
So that explains my confusion.
Yes.
I just have to be patient, right?
Yes, you do.
Okay.
Actually, you're doing pretty well here.
Okay.
This one's going to amaze you. How much dirt will a groundhog move in making a burrow?
I can tell you that because that's exactly what happened after we filled the toll back up.
1, 15 cubic feet. 2, 35 cubic feet. 3, 150 pounds. 4, 700 pounds. 5, whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes.
All it takes includes 35 cubic feet and 700 pounds of dirt.
700, wow.
One groundhog.
Wow. That's okay. Amazing.
Another tip for you.
Okay.
Groundhogs are mostly solitary creatures who can actually climb trees. I didn't know that.
Yes.
But they'll still have 2 to 5 doors to their burrows and may share the burrow with a significant other or two.
Okay.
Question. The typical groundhog burrow is how long? 30 feet? 45 feet? 80 feet? 120 feet? Long enough to reach all the doors.
That makes me really nervous if that burrow in the barn is that long.
I know.
Maybe 30 feet?
45 feet.
45 feet.
That's a lot of burrowing.
My barn
700 pounds, 15 cubic feet.
Wow.
Okay, here it is, the one you've been waiting for, kid.
Okay.
The final question. What would be the best name for Janine Wishy's groundhog? A, Woody. B, Dirtbag. C, Shadow.
I like Shadow.
I do too.
Because I never saw him until I filled his hole back up, and then he came back home and was mad. And now I don't see him again.
Plus, there's the whole Punxsutawney Phil thing.
That's right.
The February 2nd deal.
That's right.
Shadow is perfect.
Shadow.
Shadow it
is.
So
I picked the right one?
Yes, you did.
Okay,
great. I'm proud of you.
Thanks, Bob.
Okay, question for Miss Wishy from a Nick Cortolillo. As close as I can get. He's a Hoosier, Floyd Knobs, Indiana. The Hoosier strike again. But this is one right up your fig tree, Miss Wishy.
Alrighty.
I heard Janine talking about delicious-sounding figs from her garden, which prompts me to ask this question. I have a dwarf fig tree, which is about 5 years old. It is planted next to the house foundation, facing south. Each year I get some freeze back, but the plant foliage comes on very strong. I seem to get a lot of figs, but they never seem to mature to full size and ripen. I have been watering and have not used fertilizer until this year, when I used one of those tree stick type fertilizers. Same results. Any suggestions, Miss Wishy, the fig expert?
I'm not really sure, to be honest with you, because he's got it in a really good location in that south sort of warm zone.
No,
you know what I mean? So that's good. The only thing that I can think of is that you have a variety that's just not as vigorous here. I know that brown turkey really is the best variety, cultivated variety for hardy figs for us here. Another thing too, Nick, the fig that we have out at the farm has been there for a really long time, and I'm kind of thinking that maybe 5 years is not as old as it should be to do really, really well. But if you've got figs forming and they're not ripening properly, I'm a little bit stumped about that. So
Ooh.
It may just be a variety that's just not well suited to us, but I can't be certain because they really are not... I've never fertilized ours, and I don't water it. And actually, they're, you know, native to more of a Mediterranean sort of reality.
Great to me, though.
Yeah. And they kind of are better fruit-wise. You get more concentrated flavors if it's a little on the dry side. So I'm a little stumped. So I say just be a little patient. get a couple more years on it. Because I've noticed also they ripen up a lot faster on the wood that does winter over. And the older they get, the hardier they become.
Okay.
So I'm not a totally clear answer, but okay. That's all I can figure.
If you have a non-fig question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 502-FIG. No, I'm just kidding. Call us at 814-8246.
So, Bob, it's a plant story day. You get to delight us even more with the knowledge that is
whatever
swirling around in that bald head of yours.
Whatever listeners are left.
Yeah.
This one you may find hard to believe because it involves Bob and food.
Okay.
But I was out eating the other night, other than the Golden Arches, and I had something with capers on it.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was chicken. I had never
Did you like it?
Had capers before.
They're good.
I had no idea what they were.
Okay.
They looked like pickled dead peas to me,
mm-hmm.
but I was curious about the word and origin. How did I miss capers? What happened here?
Mm-hmm.
So as you know probably, the caper is a spiny shrub with kind of rounded, fleshy leaves and big white to pinkish white flowers. You ever grow one in Arizona when you live there? That's what it is. It's a native to the Mediterranean, grows wild on walls and rocky areas, has an edible bud or fruit called the caperberry. It's been around a long time. It was mentioned in the Bible in Ecclesiastes. Here we go. We're going to kick you in here.
Okay.
The Latin word is caperis spinosa.
Okay.
Linnaeus, of course, gave him the name.
Right. Spinosa meaning that it's got spiny stuff on it.
Or right? The great philosopher.
Okay.
One or the other. I'm not sure if it's the spiny guy or the great philosopher who liked capers.
Oh, right.
But you never know these things. Here's the fun part. Caperis or caperis has a lot of choices, but the favorite seems to be derived from the island of Cyprus,
mm-hmm.
which in Greek is Kypros,
mm-hmm.
which become Caperis.
Okay.
There you go.
And that's where
they found
it grew, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Good old Pliny the Elder mentioned it in his writings. It goes back to the year 2000 when the Sumerians, who invented summer actually, they used it for gout.
I think he made that up.
Arthritis,
uh-huh.
herbal tea, diverticulitis, and more important, to reduce flatulence.
Excellent.
Which I'm glad the restaurant didn't bring that up when I was eating there, but it could have been a problem. Anyway, as you know, its culinary use is either salted or pickled or used for seasoning and garnish, even in Indiana restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Southern Italian cooking. Has it been used in Southern Shelby County, too?
Absolutely, it has.
You're the girl.
It's great on smoked salmon.
Yeah.
With a little mayonnaise.
What threw me off about caper was, you know, a caper is to leap around or a prank or harebrained escapade.
But it doesn't really...
Totally different words.
Kind of fit at all. Yeah.
Or a silly bank robber gone wrong or something.
So basically the caper's harvested before, like when the flower's in a tight little bud, right?
Right.
So before it actually becomes a flower. So the flower bud of the caperis, whatever, is the caper.
You got it. Which led to a poem, a deeply philosophical, cultural, and culinary question to be answered here.
But of course.
Will someone send the answer, please? To a food that resembles long dead peas and grows upon shiny spiny shrubs, perhaps to be eaten by half-baked grubs. I don't understand how this all got started. Way back among the dearly departed, who was the first young man or lass to seek its help in passing gas? How did it get from the island of Cyprus to dining vogue with friends among us? Who was the first to eat that berry, to declare it chic and trendy and very good for all in the Hoosier State, and piled high upon my plate. Tell me, please, by email or paper, who's responsible for this caper?
They're very good, but you don't want to eat piles and piles of them at one time. Just a few.
Depends on your gas situation.
I guess. Just a few. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week.
Homegrown is produced by Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.